Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Daniel Baker. Joining us today in another two-part episode, we have Paul Cummings. We're excited to have Paul join us today because he has worked in a variety of banking platforms. Currently, he works as the Director of Risk Management at Keystone Bank and is a faculty member of the Southwest Graduate School of Banking. He has also worked as CEO of Herring Bank, a financial institution supervisor for the Texas Department of Banking, and as a COO, EVP, faculty member, and a director at a variety of banks and schools, and more notably as a senior special agent for the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Treasury. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dana, for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Paul, as I said, we're excited to have you on the show today just because of the variety of your background. But before we really dig into that, I'd like to give people an opportunity to kind of introduce themselves and how they got started in the banking sector to begin with. So, Paul, how did you start in the financial world?
Well, really, this is kind of my second go around with it. I actually started working for my dad's bank in Lubbock when I was in high school. Worked through a variety of front end positions, vault teller, commercial teller, new accounts person. Eventually, once I got to start at Texas Tech, I worked and transitioned to the audit and compliance department and did that for a couple of years prior to me joining the Treasury Department. So that's kind of my first go around. I'll be the fourth generation in my family who's been involved in the banking industry. So it's been in my family for a long period of time, from my great grandfather on down to myself.
Okay, so banking's kind of in the blood then.
It has been, yes, sir. That's correct.
Well, awesome. Well, Paul, I wanted to for this first part of this two-part special, I wanted to really kind of dig into your experiences at Homeland and the U.S. Treasury, because I mean that's not a position that you hear very often associated with banking. I mean, Treasury you do, but what did you do there? What were your roles at these two departments?
Well, I got hired originally for the Department of Treasury as a criminal investigator, senior special agent. Eventually, what I attained. Primarily at that time, the Treasury Department was looking for criminal investigators who had financial or money laundering experience. They really needed men and women who had some experience with credits and debits. And I, at that time, had a little bit of that, but really looking for money laundering experts, or at least people that had some understanding of how the financial system worked. And so I had some of that experience of working in a bank and being familiar with that type of operations. And so I was hired. I think out of my class, I think there was almost 45,000 applicants to fill only 500 slots. So it was very selective. At that time, the Treasury Department had four enforcement bureaus: the U.S. Secret Service, U.S. Customs Service, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Internal Revenue Service. Those were the four enforcement branches that Treasury agents were assigned to, or bureaus we were assigned to. And so during my tenure with the Treasury Department, I worked primarily with the United States Customs Service and with the United States Secret Service. So depending on kind of when it was and what part of my career, those were the two bureaus that I was assigned to. During that part of my law enforcement career. After I graduated from our academy, which is about 6 months, 7 months long, I was assigned to a field training officer who had probably the most extensive background in working long-term undercover assignments. So I got exposed to a lot of things as a young agent that I probably most law enforcement officers don't get exposed to because of who I was involved with from a training perspective. And so I got a lot of experience working in an undercover capacity for the first years of my Treasury Department career, and primarily working in laundering funds for criminal organizations, predominantly narcotics trafficking organizations, but also other violent felony criminal organizations, firearm smuggling organizations. I dealt with kind of the cream of the crop, you might say, with of criminals. Really the kind of what I would call the worst of the worst is kind of what I spent the first part of my career dealing with, both from a money laundering standpoint, but also working in an undercover capacity as well.
So I have to ask then, like you said that you worked undercover and money laundering kind of side of things. Did you find yourself working with financial institutions and banks? I'm assuming you did as you were going through that.
We did. We actually would approach banks a lot of times, you know, and work in concert with them when we were working some of these larger criminal organizations. Because again, the banks needed to have that information to know that we were the good guys, but right. we were having to do some transactions that obviously would be red flagged within those organizations. But yes, we did do a lot of work with various banks. I spent a lot of time reading SARS. You know, that's later on in my story, but it is very important that I have a speech that I give on a pretty regular basis, but really talks about how the banks are really a primary focus of really stopping the money laundering that happens here in the United States. It really, the banks have a unique part to play in that and do a very good job of it. But yeah, that was really the first part of my career was kind of got into that that realm of money laundering. Really follow the money. Yeah. We hear that in banking now all the time, but it really is true and accurate. And I kind of made somewhat of a career out of myself doing that exact thing, at least with that group of criminal enterprises.
Well, it's nice to hear that someone actually reads those SARs once they're submitted. I mean, sometimes it feels like you're submitting so many of them that they kind of just get lost in the void. But that's good to correct. Know that they're actually being used.
They are, and I when I was stationed here in Texas, I had out of my office we had I think 70 counties, maybe 70 counties that my office was responsible for, and for a period of probably 7 years, maybe 8 years. I read every SAR that was generated in that 70 county area. I set up a deal with FinCEN to allow them to send me those SARs directly. And so I'd come to work in the morning, and maybe some mornings I might have one or two or maybe none. But I was able to work a lot of criminal cases based off of reading those SARs. I mean, it was a great source of leads for me.
So that makes me wonder then, like what was the most, when you read a SAR, what were you looking for? Like what made a SAR effective to you? Was it just the data points that they required to fill in? Were you really looking at the narrative? Like what really made a SAR effective?
It's really the narrative was really what drove me. And when I've discussed this with other banks, I've really tried to encourage them to really, and I'm sure the examiners would kill me to say this, but not worry so much about the data points. I mean, those are important, but the narrative is what becomes so important, and it's really that first one or two or three sentences, just like in a newspaper article, that draw your attention. And I would read that, and I'd be like, oh, okay, well this narrative, this sounds interesting. Now let me look at those data points. Mm-hmm. Now let me look at the factual information. But that narrative is what really what drove me into really looking at a SAR versus looking at one and then discarding it and saying, well, that's not really interesting or it doesn't really fall within something that I'm doing or something along those lines. But yeah, that narrative becomes just super, super critical. And I think it's a skill that is really an acquired skill. It's very difficult for somebody to really do that very well to begin with. It's something that takes time, and you really have to read a lot of SARs to really and what a really well-written SAR really is. But yes, it's the narrative.
So then you say like the first two or three sentences are, I mean, just like any story, newspaper article, they're what would grab your attention or whatever. What would you kind of be looking for in those two or three sentences? Or is it literally just like attention-grabbing details? Like what would
Well, it's really attention-grabbing details, but really what I really look at when I would really analyze those narratives is, okay, what is it that the bank is seeing as compared to other customers? What is different? What is different about between this plumber in his business and any other plumber that you have in that organization?
Right.
What are the transactional differences that really are making you uncomfortable with what this customer is doing? And, you know, it's not really up to the bank to really figure out what the specified unlawful activity is. They don't need to know, is it narcotics trafficking? Is it human trafficking? Is it weapon smuggling? Is it, whatever the criminal account may be. It's really not up to the bank to figure that out. That was what my job was to
right,
do.
Right.
But it's really up to the bank to say, these transactions, this behavior is not normal for this kind of customer, or it's not normal for what this customer told us when they opened the account originally. And so when I see that kind of terminology, then that tells me that customer, that bank knows its customers, and it knows that this is not normal activity. Something's wrong here. I don't know what it is. I don't know what they're doing, but
something's going on.
And that's what would really grab my attention, because I would trust those banks to know that, yeah, this is not normal activity. So it's up to me to contact that bank, to get a grand jury subpoena, to go through whatever enforcement actions I need to do to figure out what that specified unlawful activity is that person or corporation is involved in.
So then, beside the start, you mentioned that you give the speech about how banks are like the forefront and everything like that. What else? Give me some highlights, some spark points. What else are some other things that banks can do to really be at the forefront of this?
Well, I think really, and this goes through a lot of areas of the bank, but really training, spending some time with your frontline staff, and that helps in a whole wide variety of areas. You know, one of the things that this bank has had some issues with is elder abuse. It's every bank. We're not the only ones that have that kind of issue, but really, really trying to explain to your front staff people, your new accounts folks, your anybody that has really direct customer contact, that sometimes you have to look out for your customer. And that's one of the good things about working for a community bank, in my opinion. I think that's kind of what we're expected to do to some degree. And I think that's important. I mean, to protect and serve. I mean, that was kind of
right.
kind of the motto that law enforcement officers operate under. And I think that we as bankers kind of have that same responsibility. And I think it's important for our frontline staff to be really, really trained in asking appropriate questions, you know, understanding who that customer is, understanding what their needs are. I mean, it's great opportunities to sell stuff. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's other advantages to asking questions and doing what you need to do. But there's also, you need to understand your customer and understand what they need. And my dad used to tell me all the time that a good loan officer knows his customer better than the customer knows himself. And I think I think there's some valid truth to that. So that's one of the real things that I really try to emphasize at all of the banks that I've worked at, is that really training your frontline staff to ask questions, to really be understanding of your customer, and really try to help them kind of net, because they're not the subject matter experts.
Right.
Most of the time. Some are, but most of them aren't. And it really, from that standpoint, that's where you really start detecting whether it's bad actors, whether it's elder abuse situation, whatever it is. But that you've got to rely on your frontline people to be able to ask those questions and interact with those customers appropriately. You know, as president of a bank or CEO, you don't have a lot of one-on-one customer interaction. Whereas your teller, new accounts people, that's all they do. All they do, they may see 200 or 300 of your customers during a day, during an 8-hour day. And so it becomes that position is so crucial, and it's crucial to protect the bank. It's crucial to protect the customer. And also as we just talked about, I think it's crucial to protect our financial systems in general, because once your bad actors are in your bank, you got problems. That's where you can do all kinds of stuff. The goal is to put the wire up and try to keep those folks from being able to come into your bank and committing, you know, those kind of activities that cause you issues. But yeah, training is the, and that training, whether in IT, you know, I'm always complaining, you know, we got people that are click happy. They'll We send those social media tests
and they just click right away.
and we've got the usual suspects that they just can't help themselves. I was talking to our IT director just last week about it. And our bank, just like all other banks, that we spend a significant amount of money on our firewalls and our everything that we can do to protect.
Which is great all the way up until you get to someone that clicks on something.
That's exactly right. And so how do you stop that? It's really training. It's really sitting down and having to really explain to them the dangers that we can spend millions and millions of dollars on our IT systems. But it takes is just one person to plug a thumb drive in or click on
that's it.
And it blows up. And so training your employees and it's not the bank president, it's not the CEO, but it's really the folks that are on that day-to-day, one-on-one, transactionally dealing with customers on a day-to-day. But that's where you've got to make sure you spend the most amount of money in training. And
so let me ask then, because I mean I agree with you, training of the utmost important. I've asked this of some other bank presidents and people in different positions. How do you design an effective training platform? Because I mean, certain skills like asking effective questions, like I think is utterly important, but it's so hard to teach someone to ask the effective questions. How do you get this? Like how do you encourage this?
I think, you know, we unfortunately, the world that we live in now, we do, and I hate to say this because we're doing a podcast, but we do a lot of computer-based training.
That's just
the world we live in.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, at least from my experience, I don't learn a lot from computer-based training. I learn how to take tests. That's pretty much what I learned.
Mind what you need for the multiple choice.
That's exactly right. You know, figure it out. And a lot of these kind of soft skills, these communication skills, you have to have that done in person. You have to have somebody there. You have to have somebody that understands kind of what you're looking for and really try to engage your employees to be able to teach those kinds of skill sets. And unfortunately, because of the world now, again, that we live in, we live in the moment. Everybody's on the phone, everybody's too busy. And sometimes training seems to kind of take a second seat, especially when you're having to get somebody to come in to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Face-to-face kind of training. You just hardly ever see that anymore.
Yeah.
I hate it. And so one of the things that I've encouraged here and at other banks is really for our teller supervisors, our BSA officer, our compliance officer, some of those positions that not just deploy the computer-based training, and we do that here. Don't get me wrong. We do it just like everybody else.
Of course.
But I also have encouraged, and we have done, where we do one-on-one training, or maybe we go to the teller meeting once a week that they have, and we spend 10 minutes talking about, you know your customer, talking about asking questions, talking about elder abuse, and really some of the signs and things to look for and questions to ask. And it's difficult because I'm geared to tell people no. I was in a business where confrontation, telling people no, that's not a problem for me. But I wasn't in a service industry either for the
right.
As my dad reminded me when I went on inactive status, he said, you know, you're not going to be able to point guns at people and make them do what you want them to do. Those days are probably over with.
Passed a little bit.
So you have to have that skill set, but you've got to do it face to face, and you've got to be able to have the time and make sure the bank allows you to have the time to really spend with those frontline people that have that day-to-day interaction with your customers. And our BSA officer, she goes over that red flag list with those tellers and new accounts relationship specialists all the time. She goes with them and says, you know, if we have something that comes up, we'll with the new accounts people, when it comes to elder abuse, then we'll use that as an example, and we'll show up at that meeting. Maybe for 5 or 10 minutes, we'll talk about that. But we try to use really real life examples, things that have happened in the bank, things that have happened to me or somebody else. But really, that face to face training, I think, is really where people really learn and understand. Again, as I told you about, I've got a presentation where I talk about SARs and the importance of them, and it's easy for me, you and I, to talk about that. But yeah. when I show a picture on the wall, you know, on a PowerPoint presentation, and it's a picture of me and two other guys and 400 or 4,000 pounds of cocaine. And when I say this case, it was cool. I got to do a lot of things with it, but I didn't know anything about this crook until I read that SAR. That guy was flying dope out of Mexico for months and months. Nobody knew anything about it. Mm. He was doing all kinds of crazy stuff, but yet there were some transactional things that he did at a bank that the bank thought, this doesn't right, and we'll file a SAR, and Paul Cummings read it, and here's the result. Now, that's a lot better teaching tool than a computer-based training where it says, pick out of the five, you know, what the right answer is here. Right? It just doesn't give the same, amount of gravitas to it. And so I think any of that kind of stuff, I think, is good that the bank does when they can really talk about real-life scenarios and really how it affects that bank. This is why we do that, because if you don't do that, this is what can happen to this bank.
Right.
And I think that's important. I think that's important.
So I know it was a minute ago and by a few years back for you, but I was curious about this 4,000 pounds of cocaine that you seized and everything like that. When you say it was a SAR that crossed your desk, do you know if it was like the first SAR or was it like a second SAR, third SAR?
It was the first SAR. That I read. And it was a gentleman who he was a retired general aviation pilot. That was what he had told his bank. And there were transactions and wire transfers in and out of his bank account that the bank was just uncomfortable with. They didn't have a clue what he was involved in, but they just weren't comfortable with it.
Right.
And long story short, he owned several airplanes. And so what I did, and I read that SAR, I thought, well, this is kind of interesting, but he had no criminal history. The transactions didn't seem to be all that crazy. I mean, it was some wire transfers from some countries down in Central and South America, but I mean, it wasn't anything just really out of the ordinary that I thought. But what I did, the key to the case was I looked up the tail number of his airplanes, and the FAA keeps a registry of flight paths.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was that every 2 weeks, this clown was going down to Eagle Pass and he would spend 10 or 15 minutes on the ground in Eagle Pass. And then he was taken off and flying back to Fredericksburg, Gillespie County Airport there in Fredericksburg, Texas. But he was doing that every 2 weeks. And so I don't know if you've been to Eagle Pass, but Eagle Pass, it's a nice place to visit. But I don't know that you would go there every 2 weeks to visit unless you had family or
just for 15 minutes too
on the ground, just enough time, you know, to really gas your plane back up and take off. So that really kind of raised my suspicion that something wasn't really kosher with this guy. And so one afternoon, the FAA called me and said, hey, that airplane that you've talked about, just to let you know, it's taken off again out of Eagle Pass.
Okay.
To let you know. And so at that time I was co-located at an air branch. And so we had airplanes available to the agents. And so I jumped into this King Air with a couple of other pilots, and we actually tracked that plane down. We intercepted him somewhere between San Antonio, you know, maybe Hondo, somewhere around down there. And our procedure is you get right up underneath them. They don't know that you're there. So we're talking on a discrete frequency to air traffic control. But anyway, we get within about, I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 feet of his airplane. And I was up in the front of the cockpit. And so we kind of went around to the side and I could look through into the side and all I could see were bundles. I mean, the guy couldn't even see out the sides of the airplane. Just all these bundles. And I had no clue that it was going to be just stuffed to the gills with coke. And so told the two pilots, I said, guess what? This has gone from kind of a surveillance mission to we're going to have to do an arrest when we get him on the ground. And
right.
So we landed right behind him there in Fredericksburg, and we'd had some radio problems. I couldn't get a hold of the Gillespie County Sheriff's Office or the Fredericksburg Police Department to come back me up. I mean, I needed help. I couldn't get a hold of anybody. So I had to do it by myself. I mean, the two pilots had to land the airplane. I mean, I jumped out of the back of the airplane and went running up to the front of his plane. The spinning propellers were there in front of me, and I had spinning propellers behind me. I mean, it wasn't the best tactical position I could be in. But he ended up turning the plane off. But anyway, we had all that cocaine, and not only did he have a huge load in that airplane, but he also had a load from the prior week that was still out at his ranch just north of Fredericksburg.
It ended up
being a huge case, but all he was doing was he had a small hangar down in Eagle Pass. And so what they were doing, they were crossing the drugs across, loading it into that hangar. And then he was just landing, taxiing over to his hangar, opening up the door, throwing in loading up his airplane, and then turning around and flying back to Fredericksburg. And he had been doing that for months and months. And the funny thing about it was during the interview, he said, I asked him kind of, how did you get involved in this during our interrogation? And he said, well, I used to work for the CIA. That's what he told me. And I thought that was kind of, that's not the first time I'd ever heard that.
Right.
I kind of was like, okay, whatever. But as we worked the case, we came to find out that he had actually worked for the CIA. In fact, he had been a pilot. I don't know if you saw the movie with Tom Cruise. I think it's called American Made, where he plays a smuggling pilot.
I've seen clips of it, yeah.
It came out 2 or 3 years ago, but the name of the character that he plays is a man by the name of Barry Seals. And Barry Seals, this guy had worked for Barry Seals back in the 80s. He had been one of those pilots that had flown down to Nicaragua, flying weapons during the Iran-Contra scam. Yeah. He had been involved in that. And he had just kept those contacts. And so he had continued to fly dope back up here into the United States off and on over all those years. So it was crazy. It was great. It was a weird case, but it was an interesting case. But like I said, it came off of a SAR. That guy would still be flying dope up here.
Right. Except for that piece of paper.
Except for that piece of paper that bank filled out. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, that's remarkable. Yeah, I mean, it's really awesome to hear like real life application. As you said, I mean, training, it always means a little bit more when you've got the real life application side of it going on. So it's really awesome to hear like a real life application of SARs and how effective they can be and everything.
Absolutely.
Well, Paul, unfortunately, we're going to have to take a short break here. We are unfortunately at the end of our time for this episode. So, Paul, thank you very much for joining us for today's part one of two parts. And we'll look forward to chatting with you in just a little while. Thank you very much, Paul.
Sounds good. Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate you.
For the rest of you listening in, that's Banking Matters.